Here's a black hole. So let's assume that it's a black hole in an asymptotically flat space-time, and that we're observers at infinity looking at this black hole. So we'll measure for the black hole. We can measure its mass and angular momenta, and if it has any gauge charges. And these are the conserved quantities of the black hole. The question is then if knowing these conserved quantities is enough to uniquely specify which solution describes this black hole. In four dimensions, there are uniqueness theorems that state that the black hole solutions are uniquely determined by the conserved charges. But in five dimensions, there are no uniqueness theorems for stationary black holes. In fact, there are explicit examples of non-uniqueness. These occur in pure gravity, and the solutions there, the non-uniqueness there, can be extended to supergravity. And there even exist supersymmetric black holes that violate uniqueness, classically continuous violation of non-uniqueness. Well, yeah, for instance, just in pure gravity, yeah. Or in Maxwell-Einstein theory. So, well, so the supersymmetric black holes that violate uniqueness continuously are supersymmetric black rings. And I'll talk about black rings in this talk, supersymmetric and also non-supersymmetric ones. So why is this interested in string theory? Well, in gravity, if we have a black hole, we can associate with it an entropy, which we calculate as a quarter times the horizon area. But in gravity, gravity itself doesn't tell us what microstates are responsible for this entropy. On the other hand, in string theory, we can model a black hole as some system of brains. And for that system of brains, we can count the number of states and try to match it to the number of states that we would need to reproduce this entropy on the gravity side. And it's a great success of string theory that this matching works for certain supersymmetric and near supersymmetric black holes. One thing to note, though, is that one needs to identify this brain system to match the black hole. The systems need to have the same conserved charges, for instance, the same gauge charges that the gauge charges on the gravity side translate into number of brains in the string theory. And for instance, they have to have the same angular momenta. So the question is now, if the black holes are not uniquely defined by the conserved charges, then how does string theory know for which black hole it counts the microstates if it's just some brain system that models black holes with the same conserved charges? So for the black rings, we have supergravity solutions describing them. The solutions are not uniquely determined by the conserved charges. And the question is then, in the world volume description, in the system of just brains, how do you count the entropy and how do you take care of this non-uniqueness? And in fact, which system, what is the dynamics of the brain system that that is the brain system underlying the black ring? So the talk is about supersymmetric and non-supersymmetric black rings. I should say that the brain system we wish to find on this side is some generalized version of an object called the supertube. So what I'll start with in the talk is to look at two charge systems, black rings with two gauge charges, and how they map into, well, how they're related to supertubes with two charges. Then I'll move on to three charge systems and describe supersymmetric black rings with regular horizons. And then go on to in the end, show an overview of what we know now and an outlook of what we would like to know. So this is all based on work with Roberto M. Perron, David Mateos, and Javi Rial, and also work in progress with Paul Figueras, Roberto's student. So I'll start just by describing neutral black holes and how in pure gravity non-uniqueness occurs. So I'll concentrate on just, well, it's pure gravity. I'll look for stationary solutions that describe black holes, and I wish that there are solutions that are asymptotically flat. So one set of solutions, one family of solutions, has been known for a long time, the Myers-Perry black holes, which are black holes with horizons that are topologically as S3s. They're rotating. So in principle, in five dimensions, you can have rotation in the two independent planes. But for here, for this slide here, I'll set one of those angular momentum to zero and just consider rotation in one plane. So these solutions then exist as long as the angular momentum per mass, this is the dimensional ratio in five dimensions, as long as that obeys this bound here, so it doesn't exceed that upper bound. So recently, there was another set of solutions found which describe black rings. They're rings because the horizon topology is two sphere times a circle. And these solutions exist. Well, they have an angular momentum. And well, just the intuition is that you have a distribution of mass in a ring. It's going to attract itself gravitationally. So to balance it, you need to give it a certain amount of angular momentum. So this bound says that for a certain mass, you need a minimum angular momentum to actually balance the ring. So now comparing these two bounds, we see that there's a regime in which there exist both spherical black holes and black rings. And that gives a non-uniqueness. It's a discrete non-uniqueness in the sense that for each value inside this interval here, there exists one black hole and two black rings. So that's a discrete non-uniqueness in the system. Three solutions for each value in this interval. But it was shown recently that the non-uniqueness goes even further, not in pure gravity, perhaps, but once you're allowed to turn on gauge fields and dilatons. And these objects are dipole black rings. So imagine that you have a black string, and it has a charge. So the charge you can calculate by integrating the flux over a two-sphere surrounding the string. Then you take the string and bend it up sort of violently. You're not compactifying any directions because you want the space-time to be asymptotically flat, but you take the object and bend it up into a ring and give it some angular momentum to keep it balanced. Now what was a charge before is no longer a global charge, but a dipole charge. So very analog is just having a positive charge and a negative charge. There's no net charge, but there's a dipole moment associated with the configuration. So this is, of course, just a imaginary construction of an object. But such solutions exist in Einstein-Maxwell dilaton gravity. And you can find them as exact solutions. Roberta found them earlier this year. So as I said, there's no net charge associated with these rings, but a dipole charge. And the dipole charge is not a conserved charge. So that means that we can keep the conserved charges, the mass and angular momentum, fixed, but vary the dipole charge continuously. And by then, but in doing that, we generate an infinite set of non-unique solutions. In the sense that they have the same mass and angular momentum measured at infinity, but they have different dipole charges. So this is classically that we can vary the dipole moment. So once you quantize the theory and the dipole charge correspond to the number of dipole of brains being wound around this circle here, it turns out that the non-uniqueness must be, well, of course, the non-uniqueness must be discrete because you quantize the dipole charge. So the idea is now, is there an eraser? Thank you. The idea is now that we're interested in finding charged black rings, so black rings that have conserved charges, not just dipole charges. So if I start out by just a neutral black ring solution, just the vacuum solution, I can always add a trivial direction. So I have the black ring, and I add some trivial direction to it. And I get something like a black tube. Then I can take this solution, I can add four more directions, which will be I'll take to be a 4 torus, and that will just be a spectator in all this. So I'll think of black tubes and extra 4 directions on a torus. Then I can apply boosts in the direction that I've added, and I can boost string dualities to give charge to the black tube. I can do something similar for the dipole black rings. Now it's not just adding a trivial direction, you have to add a bit more because there's the charge, well, the dipole charge. But there's still a lift to 10 dimension of the solutions, and you can apply boost and dualities to charge up the solutions. So this is what we get. We lift the solutions to 10 dimensions, and then we apply boost and t-dualities and s-duality to get a solution which describes, now again, a black tube. But you can reduce it back to 5 dimensions and have a black ring now carrying two conserved charges as measured at infinity. So now these solutions, these black rings, well, they're 5-dimensional black rings times an extra circle, and then there's the 4 torus hanging around too. The conserved charges are the mass and angular momentum as before, but now there's these two extra charges, and we can dualize to a frame where these extra charges can be interpreted as fundamental string charge and these zero brain charge. There's also a non-conserved charge, which is a dipole brain, and in this case it will be a D2 brain. So from the 6-dimensional point of view, you can imagine having the D2 brain wrapping around the direction here, so that creates the cylinder. And then you have F strings and the zero brains dissolved into that D2 brain. It turns out that there's a bound on this solution, that the mass is always greater than the sum of the charges. And it's interesting to ask then if there's some kind of extremal limit, a supersymmetric limit, where that bound is saturated. And there is. There's an extremal limit of the system where the VPS bound is saturated. It's a 1/4 supersymmetric solution describing a rotating tube. In this limit, the horizon area goes to 0. So you end up with a rotating singular, generally it's a singular tube. And in this frame, you can better see that there's the D2 brain, which is this cylindrical tube that's rotating. Also on this limit, the angular momentum will be proportional to the dipole charge, this way here. And there's an upper bound on the angular momentum that is determined by the conserved charges and the dipole charge. So these solutions had been seen before. They're supergravity supertubes, and they were found by Emperan, Mateos, and Townsend in 2001. And, well, there's a motivation for that they were looking for these solutions, which comes from the world volume description. So Mateos and Townsend had described these configurations that are called supertubes. So those are configurations where you have a bound state of these 0 and F1s, and they blow up into a D2 brain, and the D2 brain is balanced by having angular momentum. So the description of this is a D2 brain. It's put into a cylinder. It's set in flat space. So you turn on electrical fields from having the F-strings, fundamental strings, and you turn on a magnetic field for the D0 brains. And then you use the Born-Enfeld action, where G here is the induced metric, F is the flux up here. And then try to just look at the energetics, which means that for fixed charges, fixed D0 and F1 charge, you minimize the energy as a function of the radius of this tube. And one finds that the energy that you get from constructing the Hamiltonian from this Lagrangian is bounded from below by the sum of the charges. And there's a value, there's a choice for the radius that exactly saturate this bound. And that's the configuration that turns out to be 1/4 supersymmetric. So the radius here is then determined in terms of the angular momentum per dipole charge. And the angular momentum comes in the world volume description as a pointing vector from the electric field and the magnetic field on the tube. There's also, more generally, there's an upper bound on the angular momentum, which is the same upper bound that was found in the supergravity solution. So now just comparing the two. Comparing the two, we see that the gravity solution that describes this rotating tube matches matches quantitatively the parameters found in the well volume description. So the interpretation is that you have the well volume description where you treat the brains as probes, and then there's the supergravity description where you include the back reaction of these brains on the background. So to summarize that, so this is the summary of the two charge one dipole case. So you have a well volume description of a supertube, so 1/4 supersymmetric. You include the back reaction on the geometry, and then find the supergravity supertubes. These are the gravity solutions. Then you kick a little bit of energy into the system and get something that we know look like a non-extremal black tube. Then the BPS bound is no longer saturated. Once reduced, the system down to 5 dimensions, you get a black ring. So in other words, going backwards, from the black ring to the tube, to the supertube. So this is the first connection between supertubes and black rings. And one way of saying it is that if you thermalize by adding a little bit of energy into and the extremal supertube, then you can get to a black ring. Well, we'll be interested in systems which have free charges. Well, we'd be interested in black holes in 5 dimensions for which the extremal limit gives a regular horizon. So let me try to mention some motivation for looking for supersymmetric black holes with regular horizons in 5 dimensions. Well, first of all, there are certain restrictions on what kind of black holes you can have. Harvey Vial showed that for a special case, the simplest theory you could work with, which is 5-dimensional. In 5 dimensions, it's n equal 1 minimal supergravity. Then, if you have a black hole, the event horizon has to be topologically either a 3 torus, or a 2 sphere times a circle, or a squashed S3. He also went on and showed that if the horizon topology is the squashed S3, and it's a black hole in an asymptotically flat spacetime, then the only solution is the so-called BMPV black hole, named after the people who found it. So this BMPV black hole, well, it has the squashed S3 horizon. It's rotating. It has angular momenta in 2 planes. And it turns out that these angular momenta must be equal in magnitude. But this, well, while the mass is required to be the sum of the charges, in this case there are 3 charges, is a requirement of supersymmetry, it is not required by supersymmetry that the angular momentum should be equal. So it's natural to ask if there are any supersymmetric black holes which have unequal angular momenta in the 2 planes of rotation. Furthermore, you can say, well, from string theory, we know we have supertubes. And if you take some system consisting of supertubes, then you might be able to add the 3rd charge to them and generate black hole solutions, again, with unequal angular momenta in the 2 planes. Furthermore, there is a conjecture squared here. So this is a conjecture by Mathur and his collaborators. And that conjecture led Bena and Krauss to conjecture the existence of supersymmetric black rings. And these things do exist. So the black objects, they fall in this category of event horizons. And they have angular momenta in 2 planes. One is just like the black ring angular momentum we saw before that balances the ring, and the other one is associated with the 2 sphere of the horizon. And it turns out that the angular momentum that is associated with the S1 is always greater than the angular momentum associated with the 2 sphere of the black ring. So these are supersymmetric solutions. And what I'll do is to describe briefly how we found them in 5-dimensional minimal supergravity, and then talk about how they generalize to more complicated theories. So here's the construction. So I look at black rings in 5-dimensional minimal supergravity. The theory has, well, it has gravity, and then it has a gauge field, and it has a Chern-Simons term, too. And Gondlet, Gutowski, Hao, Pagas, and Javi Real, they analyzed this theory for supersymmetric solutions and found that if any supersymmetric solution must be such that it has a non-space-like killing vector. So since we're interested in black holes, we'd like to look at the case where the killing vector is time-like, so call that DDT. Then generally, since V is a killing vector, we can write the metric in this form here. So in this form, you have the killing direction. You have an off-diagonal piece that will describe the rotation of the black hole. And then you have some scalar F that appears two places. And there's a four-dimensional space, which is the base space, what we call the base space. And it turns out the supersymmetry requires that this base space is hyperkähler. In our cases, the base space is always just going to be flat space. This omega here is a one form in the base space. And we can define from that, we can pick out from this one form the self-dual part of the two form. So this, well, so it's just the exterior derivative acting on omega, and you pick out the self-dual part in the base space with respect to the base space metric. And you include a factor of this scalar F just for convenience. Then if you define F to be the derivative of this form that occurs here too, and then this extra part with the self-dual part G plus, this will be the gauge field for the solution. Now you have to impose the equations in motion. This just follows from supersymmetry. So imposing the equations in motion for F and the Bianchi identity gives two conditions. G plus has to be closed. That just follows from the Bianchi identity for F. And the equation of motion for F gives that the Laplacian from this base space acting on the functions F has to be this G plus, the self-dual part squared. And this is contracted with respect to the metric on the base space. So generally, F would be could be a harmonic function if this right-hand side was zero. But we'll see for the solutions we're interested in that it's not generally a harmonic function. So the strategy for solving these equations is to pick a base space, then make an ansatz for the one forms, plug in here, describe what G plus is, solve G plus so that it's close, and then plug in here. It turns out that for the ansatz we make, that this right-hand side is going to be independent of omega, but certainly depend on what metric we choose on the base space. And then we can solve this equation for F, plug back into G, and find omega. So which base space should we choose? Well, when we describe the supersymmetric limit of the two charged black rings, giving these supergravity supertubes, the solutions look something like this. So it's a 10-dimensional solution. Don't worry too much about the coordinates. It's not too important here. Well, it has a piece that looks very much like the one we need for the supersymmetric solution. This function here will be something like f squared in the other solution. Then there's the one form we see here. And we also see that there's what we will use as the base space. So you have to compactify these other directions in order. So this is the four torus, and this is the extra six direction in order to get down to the five-dimensional solution. Well, in this case, the base space had this form. The x coordinate you can think of as a polar coordinate, as an polar angle, and y is something like the inverse of a radial coordinate. But in any case, you can do a coordinate transformation and see that this space here is just flat space. So that's the natural candidate for the base space of finding supersymmetric solutions. Furthermore, there are these functions hi, which in this case have this very simple form. And x minus y turns out to be harmonic functions in this space here. So now we have a good starting point for finding supersymmetric solutions. So again, this is restricted to minimal supergravity. We pick the base space, which is this flat space in xy coordinates. And then we make an ansatz for omega, that it's just this general form. phi is the coordinate on the two-sphere, the angle of the two-sphere, and psi is going to be the angular coordinate describing the S1 of the black rings. Well, we pick F inverse to have this form. There's a harmonic function, which is just very similar to what we had in the two charge cases. But then it turns out that when we solve the equation, this equation here, when you try to solve this, this right-hand side is non-zero, so we need a non-harmonic piece. And again, inspired from some supersymmetric limit of more general black rings, it was a natural guess to put in this non-harmonic function. Then these two constants are just fixed as integration constants. And this one here assures that the solutions become asymptotically flat. Well, then one goes through the procedure I've described before and calculates the one forms. They turn out to be a little more complicated in form. And from this, one can then construct the gauge field, which takes this form here. So again, I don't want to focus too much about the coordinate system or the specific solutions, but more describe some of the properties of the solutions. So minimal supergravity arises as a special limit of other theories once you take the charges to be equal of the solutions. So it's pretty easy from the minimal solutions to generalize to solutions where the charges are actually different. And the interesting setup can be described in 11 dimensions, where the rings now have, the solutions now have three charges and three different dipole charges. So the three charges are going to be M2 rings. So let me say we have the five-dimensional space, and then we add a six torus to get to 11 dimensions. And then these three M2 rings sit orthogonally on the six ring. Then the dipole brains are M5 brains, and they each intersect. They intersect over a contractible cycle in the five-dimensional space, which is just the S1 of the black ring. And then they intersect pairwise over two directions in the six torus in this way here. So there are also other people who generalized the solutions. One paper by Binner and Warner also included more general cross sections for the solutions. And Gauntlet and Gutowski, they also looked at configurations where you have multiple rings, so all concentric. The rings are concentric, and then they can lie in different planes. One, to understand the microscopics of the systems, it's usually useful to go to a dual description, so you reduce down to 2A and do dualities to get to type 2B supergravity solution, where the net charges, instead of being M2 brains, are D1, D5, and momentum running along the intersection of the D1, D5. The dipoles, in that case, dualize to being D1, D5, and Kaluza-Klein monopole. So this is the description I'll think about, or have in mind, for the next slides. Well, so these solutions generally have seven parameters. So I should also say I'm also just thinking about the round black rings. I'm not deforming it. I'm not looking at the concentric one either. It's just the circular black rings in this description. So there are seven parameters in the solution. And five of them are corresponding to conserved charges. So these are the three gauge charges, D1, D5, and momentum. And the two other conserved charges are the angular momentum at infinity. And it turns out that this is the angular momentum associated with the S1, and it's always greater than the one associated with the S2. The mass of the system is just fixed by the BPS condition, that it's the sum of the charges. There are also three non-conserved charges, which are these dipoles. And one dipole is going to be fixed as combination in some combination of the two other dipoles and the conserved charges. So this leaves, a twofold infinite non-uniqueness classically. Again, because we can fix these five parameters at infinity and then vary independently two of the dipole charges. Once we quantize the system and the charges become number of brains, then the non-uniqueness becomes discrete, but it actually also becomes finite because the dipole charges are bounded from above by the number of the net number of brains, the G1-D5 and momentum. So, well, so in the quantum theory, you only have a discrete, finite non-uniqueness of the system. Well, one can then write down the horizon area, and it takes this form here. You can see that it explicitly depends on the dipole charges. Well, there's this part here, which is the product of the three net charges, and then there's the angular momentum coming in. And the dipole charges appear as the product of the three of them here, and also through these q tildes, which is constructed as in this way here, in the q2 tilde and q3 tilde, just permutations of this. So some of this looks a bit familiar. If you take away this term here and that term, it looks like the entropy of a BMPV black hole. So one could hope that knowing how to calculate the entropy in string theory of the BMPV black hole, you can do something similar here and try to get this entropy formula. But it doesn't work that well. I should also say that this quantity inside the square root should always be positive, of course, to get a regular horizon, and that turns out to be exactly the condition that there are no closed time-like curve outside the horizon in the space-time.
Yeah. Why are the better moments bounded above? Can you repeat that?
So I didn't say why, but the reason comes from looking at the explicit solution. And you can see that this harmonic type function, it has a q minus a little q squared in it. And it turns out in order for this solution here to always be positive, and you need it to always be positive to avoid having naked singularities, then this quantity must be positive. And this gives the bound in the solution. This bound also occurs in a different way when I come from a non-extremal point of view. So I can say something about this one as I describe the non-extremal solutions that we have found. Okay, so we'd like to try to understand the entropy of these objects. So on one side we have the gravity solution, and we wish to identify the brain system. Now it's pretty obvious which brains should go into it because we already identified that, but I think it's still a bit open what the dynamics of this system really is. One naive picture could be just to imagine that the system is free, two charged supertubes put on top of each other, but then you'd have to make it form some kind of bound state, and it's not completely clear how this happens. There's been constructions of supertubes with free charges in a world volume description where you ignore the back reaction on the geometry. And these were by Josef Binner and Pierre Krauss. But they only have two dipoles. So the way they set up the calculation is to take a duality frame where they have a D6 brain, and then they put the other brains inside of it. But one of the dipole charges in that frame is going to be an NS5 brain, and there's no description on NS5 inside a D6. So that's why they can't capture the third dipole. We tried then also a description where we actually could describe the third dipole. So this is a description from 11-dimensional point of view, where you use that intersecting brains can be described in terms of one of the brains where the other brains sit inside its world volume. Well, the intersection you describe inside one of the brain. So these are calibrated supertubes. But again, they don't capture all the features of the black rings. They don't capture, for instance, the second angular momentum associated with the S2. But it would be really, one of the things that would be nice to understand is if you can do a world volume description that captures all the features of the three charge free dipole black rings. But that's still open. The second part is how to deal with the non-uniqueness of the rings from the point of view of calculating the entropy. And the idea we had, even going back from looking at near-extremal two-charged black rings, was to do a calculation similar to the one that is done for the BMPV black hole. But you need to identify a certain sector of the system which is characterized by the dipoles. And this is somewhat natural to do, because you need to say something about the system, how the angular momentum is carried. This is something about characterizing the dynamics of the brain system. Well, there's also the point of view of ADS-CFT. So you could hope that there's an ADS-CFT correspondence that could help describe the entropy of the black rings. But now new features arise when you try to do that. So if we take the decoupling limit of the system, we want to decouple the modes, the modes on the bulk from the modes on the brain. And that's a limit where alpha prime goes to zero for the D1D5 momentum system. And when you take this limit, then you find a new solution in type 2B. And this solution, well, it has two limits in which it's simple, and then the rest of it is more messy. So in what is the asymptotic limit, this new solution reduces to ADS3 times a free sphere, where the size of the ADS3 and the free sphere are the same. But, its length, the radii are described by the net charges, the D1 and the D5 charges. Then as you go in, as you go a little bit in from the asymptotic limit, the metric is no longer a direct product of two factors here. Well, I should say there's also the four tours hanging around. But okay, it's no longer a direct product of two factors. And as you go in, you find that in a near horizon limit, so going very close to the ring, you find another ADS times an S3, but now modded out by the discrete group that is characterized by the number of Kaluza-Klein monopoles in the solution, in the original solution. Now, the size of this ADS and the S3 is now characterized by the dipole charges and not the global charges. One can view this geometry, then, as a near horizon limit of a BTC black hole, an extreme of BTC black hole. And that will capture essentially the area of the original black ring, almost, except that there is a slight difference in the system. On the contrast, if you take a BMPV black hole and take the same decoupling limit, you find that everywhere locally, it's an ADS3 times an S3. So that's a much simpler system to study from an ADS-CFT point of view. In this case here, well, we have an ADS times an S3 in the asymptotic limit, which is the UV. And then we have another ADS times S3 in what should be the infrared. So the question is, could we view this geometry as the gravity dual of some renormalization group flow in the field theory description? So since there's an ADS in both ends, you should have a CFT in both ends. So just naively, you have in one CFT, you turn on maybe a BEV, or you somehow deform the theory, and this induces the flow that gets you down to this theory in the infrared. And one thing would be really nice to understand how this flow is induced in the UV conformal field theory. And maybe that could tell us something about the dynamics of the system and how the system really works. No, just the S3. Just the S3. Yeah.
Freely?
I think so. It's just a very simple identification in the metric. Sir? It may have, I'm not sure. So one check you can do to see if this would describe an RG flow is to compare the radius of the ADS at infinity and near the horizon. And you find that, well, the radius is always bigger in the UV, so that would be some equivalent of a C theorem saying that the central charge in the UV is bigger than for the infrared theory.
So
the ADS arises here only locally. When you actually do the near horizon limit, you find some some coordinates. So you have to do a coordinate transformation to see the ADS explicitly. But you can see that the geometry that you actually get is the BTC geometry.
And there is a problem singularity writing BTC inside that ADS
table. I'm not sure what you mean.
It's in BTC has a singularity.
Yes. From the identification.
So I was wondering what is the meaning of that similarity?
I'm not sure because I haven't studied this geometry much. So I don't know exactly how it relates to the BTC case. But yeah, it would be something that would be nice to understand how the factor arises from the geometry. Well, so I'll try to give an overview here of the current status. So this column here is the two charge case. So there's the, just to summarize the other slide, is the two charge one dipole world volume supertubes. And then there are, well, you include the back reaction on the geometry, get the supergravity solutions, put a little bit of energy into the system, get the black tubes, and reduce down to five dimensions to get the black rings in five dimensions. Now, there was a world volume description describing three charge two dipole black rings. And we can take the three charge three dipole black supertubes and set one of the dipoles to zero. And it then turns out that you get a supergravity supertube, but it no longer has a horizon. So this will be a singular supertube. You can then try to match to the world volume description. And while this match worked really well, there's a slight discrepancy in this match here, which is not quite well understood yet. So the difference is that if you look in the world volume description, then there's an upper bound on the radius of the tube, which is given as the product of the charges, the net charges, and then divided by the sum of the global charges also when there's the dipole factors too. So this is what comes from the world volume description. Now, if you look in the supergravity description, this charge, well, this factor here is not just the third charge, but actually third charge minus the product of the two dipoles. So this is for the case where I set the third dipole to zero. There's, of course, a problem in the gravity solution to really identify what is this radius, because it's a singular tube, so you can't use the proper size or something like that. But you use what worked in the two charge case was using the size of the object in the base space. And here, if you try to do the same, you find almost the same formula, except with this Q3 replaced by a shifted Q3. And it would be really nice to understand how this happens. Well, you can also try to go from this system to go non-extremal. And we have solutions that describe black tubes that in their extremal limit become free charge solution with two dipoles. What is really funny is that as you go a little non-extremal, you actually generate the third dipole of the solutions. And well, typically when you go down to five dimensions too, you get black rings with three charges and three dipoles too. It might just be a feature that we don't have the most general solution describing non-extremal black rings or black tubes, that we get this extra third dipole. But it was a bit surprising to see. From the case of the black supertube with three charges and three dipoles, we don't know yet the most general solution here. And also, as I pointed out before, the world volume description of three charge, three dipoles is also not known. Okay, so in this case here, where I take the extremal limit, there was the question of where this bound, that the dipoles were bounded from above by the global charges, where it came from. So I'll typically have a relation like this, has to be bigger or equal to zero, well, just strictly greater than zero, in order to have the regular horizon for the gravity solutions. It's really funny to see that when you take, so this was for the extremal solutions. If you take the non-supersymmetric solutions, then there's not a similar bound, but there's another condition you have to impose on the solutions, which is a solution that the ring is balanced. This even occurred for the neutral rings. So in that case, if you don't tune the parameters correctly, you'll have a conically singular disk inside the ring. So there's a conical disk inside here. And what it really says is that if the ring tries to rotate faster than it should be, then there will be a disk in here trying, a conical disk trying to pull in the ring. If it's rotating too slowly, then the disk will provide a push to balance the ring. So there's a specific condition that avoids the conical singular disk. And well, this is what we usually call the balancing condition. So when you take the extremal limit to go from this non-extremal system to the supersymmetric system, you'll find that the balancing condition turns into an inequality, and it's precisely this inequality here. This is what we find for the case, again, where we set one dipole to zero, since we don't know the most general solutions. So it's very interesting that this condition comes from a very physical condition in the non-supersymmetric solutions. There's another thing that happens too, which is in the supersymmetric solution, we have this condition here, so let me now replace it with the supergravity solution. So this condition here, this inequality, also appears in the supergravity solution. This comes from a condition that there are no closed time-like curves outside the horizon for the case where you set one dipole to zero. And this condition also arises when you go non-extremal. But it comes in a different form. It comes from another condition that there are no pathologies in the solutions. These pathologies are related to Dirac Messner strings. So essentially the same as the Dirac condition for monopoles, but in a geometric way, in a different geometric way. So the condition is that there are no Dirac Messner strings. And as you take the extremal limit of this condition, again, just like here, it turns into an inequality, and it's precisely this inequality that we get. So this condition is related, again, also to pathologies that can be translated into causality, pathologies. So it's interesting that it also gives a causality condition in the extremal limit. Over here, it's a balancing condition that turns into a condition that we have a regular solution. So it's just a fun way to see how the inequality in the supersymmetric solutions appear from the non-extremal point of view. So here at the end, I'll just like to just say that the entropy, well, first of all, one should identify the brain system and understand the dynamics of it, and then find out how to deal with the non-uniqueness of the system. And finally, it would be a lot of fun to try to understand the ADS-CFT correspondent and try to understand this RG flow better and the geometries in both ends of the flow. So this is what I wanted to say. So you say instead of compactifying 11-dimensional supergravity on a 6-torus, you want to compactify it on a Calabi-Yau? Okay. So what the setup is here is that you take the 11-dimensional theory on a 6-torus, and then you can look at the equations. You actually reduce the 11-dimensional theory with a special ansatz, so it's a truncation of the most general theory you can get. So you'll see with that truncation, the theory turns into n equal 1 minimal supergravity, but coupled with two extra vector multiplets. So that gives that is essentially the theory in 5 dimension that we solve.
No,
So I think if you do a more general Calabi-Yau, you can get, again, by the reduction to 5 dimensions, you can get minimal supergravity, but now coupled to n extra vector multiplets. And in that case, we can just write down the solutions. Just take n extra vector multiplets for the 5-dimensional theory, and you can write down the solution explicitly, just in a precisely analog way.
Well,
so you have to first reduce down to 4 dimensions, and for the 5-dimensional solution, that you need some direction that will be suited for that. So okay. Yes. Oh, so you would treat that. I mean, in the limit where you take the ring and you take an infinite radius, then you get in 5 dimensions a black string, and you can that is some 4-dimensional black hole times a line, essentially. So in that case, you have a 4-dimensional black hole, and in that case, you can write down there's an entropy formula. It's the invariant entropy formula by Barrett, Cole, and Kalash that describes that you can actually match to, and Bina and Krauss did match to that. I'm not sure if that's a similar construction to what you suggest.
Yeah, I guess so. I was just wondering.
Yeah, I mean it might be equivalent to when you take the infinite radius limit, the dipoles become global charges. So you can probably relate them in that way.
Right.
Yeah.
So you would not do that.
But try to do it directly. Yeah. But that might be a good way to try to do it. Yeah. Ah, okay. So that's another. There is. Okay. Let me try to find the slide. So here, so there's the bound here that says that we don't want any closed naked time-like curves in the geometry. And as you can approach that bound, you take and keep all the asymptotic charges fixed and just vary 2 dipole moments that are free. And then you can ask, how does the area behave? And you can always approach this bound here, so you'll have the parameters for which you are allowed to have the ring is bounded by this condition, and you can always approach it. So at some place, the minimum of that entropy is 0 by that condition. So if I draw So if I draw a plane, say I vary the Q1 and Q2, and then I want to plot as a function of these two parameters the horizon area for some fixed parameters, then typically it looks like there's a blob. And the boundary of this blob is determined that by precisely the condition that what's inside the square root is positive. Then, as I go inside, the entropy increases, and it reaches a maximum at some point. So there is a sense in which you can say, well, there's a non-uniqueness, but there's one specific choice of dipoles, of dipole charges, that maximizes the entropy. And one thing you could also ask to try to understand from the microscopic theory is what characterizes the configurations that maximize the entropy for fixed global charges. Well, also, you can also say, well, there's also, if you fix the horizon area to some other value, you have a one-parameter family of solutions with that particular area. But there's one specific one that is picked out. Yeah. So once you quantize the charges also, of course, you don't have this continuous set of values. So it will be discrete in some sense. And then it may be it's perhaps a little less obvious that there's a unique state picked out. But it's again, you can just pick the charges to be very big, and then you almost have a unique set.